you're listening to Show Me Your Titles. I'm Kathy Dela Cruz in San Diego.
And I'm Erin Donovan in San Francisco. Today we are doing our first ever tribute episode, and we have selected Suzanne Beer, the Danish filmmaker who made Things We Lost in the Fire, After the Wedding, and Brothers. Kathy, why don't you get us started with Things We Lost in the Fire?
Yes, thank you, Erin. Suzanne Beer, for those of you who don't know, is a Danish producer, director, and writer. She's currently recognized as one of the most influential contemporary filmmakers of Denmark. Her 2006 film, After the Wedding, which we'll talk about soon, was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film, which we all know is not the easiest thing to get nominated for. Cough, cough. 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days.
Aww.
Yes. Things We Lost in the Fire is, like I said, filmmaker Suzanne Beer's venture into U.S. filmmaking. It's a 2007 film, which is in which a recent widow invites her husband's troubled best friend to live with her and her two children. As he gradually turns his life around, he helps the family cope and confront their loss. Erin, why did you, like so many other people, hate this film before ever even seeing it?
I described it as a hot mess without realizing I was punning. And I think it was the casting of Halle Berry and Benicio del Toro, who I think, like, between the two, I was like, we'll chew through all the scenery in this film and there won't even be anything left to it. I was modestly surprised by this film and some of the, how emotionally honest it felt at times, but I still have to think that there was just a lot of, I think, like, what Tim Gunn would say on Project Runway, like, a lot of look in this film. And it, in terms of filmmaking, that just means a lot of just stuff piled on this story that I felt at times was not terribly believable. And, yeah.
Well, Erin, what do you mean that you thought that Halle Berry and Benicio del Toro would, what did you say, like, chew through the film?
they chew the scenery a little bit.
What do you mean by that?
They're a little hammy.
You think they're hammy. Could you elaborate?
I think they overact in, like, every project they ever do.
Okay, well, I definitely want to talk about that in a minute, their acting. And also, I mean, I do disagree with you a little bit, of course. I wanted more from Things We Lost in the Fire, but overall I was pleasantly surprised that it was not, as you punningly said, a hot mess, exactly. I want to first mention that Suzanne Beer did not write this film. As far as I know, she really only, you know, she primarily works with screenwriters. She'll start out with a story, and a screenwriter will actually turn it into a screenplay for her, and they'll collaborate. Mm-hmm. But a man named Alan Loeb actually wrote the screenplay for this, and it was surprisingly, I think surprisingly, his first feature film script that was made into a film. And of course, now he has, like, he's on fire. Another pun. I apologize.
And all those scripts that have been shelved are going to be getting made pretty soon.
Yeah, totally. And I think, you know, it says something about this film. Well, it definitely wasn't successful in terms of box office value. I feel like I think a lot of people recognized it as, quote unquote, a lot better than I thought it would be. And, you know, I think...
Isn't that kind of rooted in, though, like, everyone thinks Halle Berry makes terrible choices and Benicio del Toro is just, like, probably drunk all the time? Like, they're like, yeah, it looked better than I thought it was going to be, only because I just thought it was going to be a disaster.
Yeah, and it's actually, I think, a really nice film. The thing that I actually really appreciated about this film was how straightforward it was. There really are no surprises in this film. It really is what it is. It's exactly what it is, but it's still compelling. And I think the title of the film is probably my favorite part of the film. I think it's a really great title. I think naming things actually is one of the hardest things in the world to do. I will never have kids.
I agree, actually.
I will never have kids because I will just name them. I'll just name them kid number one, kid number two until they're like 25 and can name themselves. But it's funny, the title here actually reminds me of the title of Alice Siebold's bestseller from a few years ago, The Lovely Bones. And it reminds me of that because of the way both these stories are told. And so I want that to be our recommended suggested reading to accompany this film.
We got a couple of compliments about our book recommendations recently, and it has all gone to Kathy's
head. It's all gone to my head. I'm completely reading Rainbow over here now. But anyway, no, but have you read The Lovely Bones? Have you read The Lovely Bones, Erin?
I have not.
Well, for anyone who has, you know, you read this book, and by the time you get to the page that's like 150 pages into it, where the title is mentioned in the actual story, it's pretty amazing. It's a pretty amazing feeling, and it's a great feeling of catharsis. And I feel like this film did that for me too. I kept thinking, at first I was like, ooh, I hope they don't say like things we lost in the fire, because that will be so cheesy. But it really paces itself well, and when it finally gets there, I think it's a really nice moment in the film. And I almost wish it would have ended there, because I feel like there's some unnecessary stuff toward the end. Erin, does this...
Yeah, I absolutely agree about that scene, actually. That aspect of the plot was something I enjoyed. I thought it gave a nice subtext to it.
Yeah.
And provided a nice title.
Exactly. Erin, did this film at all remind you a little bit of Under the Sand, a film that we reviewed not too long ago?
No.
You know, this film actually did make me think of Under the Sand. I mean, I don't think it's nearly as good as Francois Ozon's Under the Sand with Charlotte Rampling, but I feel like there are similar things here. I mean, they both deal with a woman who has to completely change her way of life very suddenly because her husband has died a very sudden death. And I feel like it's these little moments where Halle Berry's character as the wife has to deal with these really small things, such as the way that she goes to sleep in bed every night. And, you know, just these little things that I think are kind of done really well that reminded me of Ozon's Under the Sand.
Can I, to that point, mention something I really hated about this movie?
Yes.
It's a small thing, but it's so cliche, and I'm so exhausted with seeing like grown middle-class women who are, I'm not kidding, afraid of computers. There's at one point, like right after her husband dies, where apparently only he ever used the computer, even though she's like this yuppie woman living in this mansion. And like, it just, the computer makes like a beep, and she like literally jumps and like hides behind her brother and asks her brother to like check on it.
Erin,
I never need to see that again, like ever in life or in movies. Erin, like, I'm tired of seeing women who are scared of computers.
I have to completely disagree with you there. I don't think that's what's happening in that scene at all. I think what that scene is about is that's really her husband's room, and it's filled with his things. It's completely his room. It's like the equivalent of your child just died and you don't know what to do with their room. It feels wrong to go into
it. The computer's in the kitchen, Kathy.
What?
The computer's in the kitchen, and she even says, like, I'm scared of computers. I was just like, no.
The computer is not in the kitchen. It's in its own room. There's a door to it, like, off to the side. And when Benicio del Toro finally goes in it toward the end, he actually is uncomfortable because she hasn't changed a thing. There are all these photos of him and her, and it's very much like his room. Like, I think it's not about her being scared of technology as it is about her feeling really uncomfortable going into this space that's just covered with him and probably, like, smells like him. I completely see that scene in a completely different way than you do.
I don't want to see that anymore.
Okay, well, I think you're seeing it a way that I didn't see it. That's all I will say.
It's like
that.
An AIM, like, alert comes up, and she's like, oh, no! Like, she jumps, Kathy, and she hides behind a dude, and she's like, please go check on
Erin,
it.
Erin, I just want to tell our listeners, the reason she jumps is because someone is instant messaging her dead husband, and she hasn't told everyone that he's dead yet because it just happened. So I think it's more about the idea of, I don't want to have to deal with this right now. I'm already dealing with so much. His funeral is in a few hours. I'm not going to get online and tell someone who thinks that he's here on the computer. Actually, this isn't your friend. Your friend is actually dead right now. Like, I think it's much more about that than about...
I think the way that scene carries out, and we should stop because this is such a short scene, like, I don't know if we should be dwelling on it, but I think the way that scene carries out is different than what you're saying.
Well, I completely disagree with you, but, I mean, that's that. I mean, I think the fact that she tells her brother to lie to the person on the computer that he's...
Yeah, she tells her brother to pretend like he is David Duchovny.
Yeah, well, I mean, can you imagine sending someone an instant message that says, I'm sorry, he's dead, don't instant message this address anymore, as opposed to just being like, can't talk right now, and, you know, dealing with it later or never? Like, I think it's actually a much more complex thing that's going on than what you are...
Actually, something like this happens in another movie we're going to review today, so let's bookmark it and come back.
Okay. Well, I also want to say I really like about this film is that this film isn't just about a lonely woman. This is about a lot of lonely people, including not just, you know, the wife, but also the, you know, the good close friend, you know, of this man that's gone. And I really like that we see that, you know, a lot of people are feeling lonely because of this person gone. And the way that we see that, I just feel like it's done really well with the friend who, you know, it's like, it's this really intense thing where, like, everyone needs something from Benicio del Toro's character. And he's kind of, like, the least likely person that could ever help anyone out. He's this, like, drug addict loser. And, you know, everyone needs something from him because, for some reason, he can provide this companionship. It's the only thing he can provide, but he can.
I know, even, like, there's this moment that's almost funny, but, like, the neighbor comes by and he's like, well, I always go jogging with David Duchovny. And he, like, kind of has a beat, and he's like, so are we going to go jogging or what? And Benicio del Toro's like, I'm smoking. Like, that's his response. I'm smoking.
Yeah.
I'm really busy right now. I'm smoking.
Yeah. You know what, Erin? One of my favorite scenes in this film was actually the murder scene, if you can believe that. I normally wouldn't ever say that a scene of violence was, you know, my favorite in the film, but it's really...
Is it because you hate men? You're a feminazi and you hate men?
No, it's, you know, it's off-screen violence, but I just felt like that was done so well.
Is it off-screen? It feels on-screen.
It feels on-screen in many ways, but the actual... I mean, it's not like we see someone get shot. We see the gun go off and we know that someone is getting shot, but I felt like it was done really well here. Just how kind of... it. The way that it's shot, the way that it's executed, no pun intended, again, God, is, you know, I just feel like it's very much like this happens very suddenly, you know, the loss of this character, and I feel like it's kind of, it really is so believable. The, like, you're just minding your own business, going to the grocery store, and you see this horrible thing happening, and you try and get involved, and this is what happens.
You try to do the right thing, it just gets worse and worse and worse. Yeah.
Yeah, I felt like it was done really, really well here.
With the ice cream melting and everything?
I don't remember the ice cream melting. But, and something I want to talk about later with, you know, the last film we'll review today, Brothers, is that I think both that film and this film, for me, the strongest scenes in the film are the ones of the most violence in the film, but that's something we'll get to later. And by strong, I mean, I just think that, like, if this was a story and I had to pick out one sentence that basically said what the entire story was about, you know, I'd pick that scene in a way. But anyway, I have to say, though, I think the writing actually could have been a little stronger.
You don't say.
Yeah, it was pretty unbelievable to me that, you know, Benicio del Toro's character used to be a successful lawyer, but maybe I just don't hang out with enough, you know, with enough drug addicts who actually used to be successful. All the drug addicts I hang out with have never been successful to begin with.
To say the least. I mean, and also, like, he has, like a spell of, like, 3 days where he's, like, having good days. So, like, his neighbor's like, well, let me get you a job at my bank. Like, what?
I didn't find that so unbelievable because I just felt like rich people can do shit like that. That's, like, how I saw that scene.
But do they do it by, like, oh, well, sure, you're a heroin addict, but you, like, haven't used in 6 days? Well, shit, let's get you a job.
Yeah, I think I just felt like it was an extreme circumstance where people were trying to really fill a void. And so in that respect, like, I could believe it a little more. But I did love certain things, like little details, character details that made the characters really just not just these, you know, one-dimensional stereotypes. But like the fact that the daughter is vegetarian, I kind of loved that. Like, there was no reason we needed to know that she was vegetarian, but it adds so much.
So is Benicio del Toro.
What?
Benicio del Toro's character is as well.
Yeah, it's kind of this really nice thing. And you know what, Erin? I actually heard someone describe this as a quote-unquote guy's chick flick.
Interesting.
Hey, so I know we need to stop talking about this soon, although who cares? We can always edit it out if we need to. But I'm editing this week. But Erin, so one thing I liked, and I'm going to completely defeat my own statement here, is I like how it's actually never discussed in the film that you know, this is kind of about an interracial couple. I just liked how, you know, these families were able to interact with each other, and it's just not a part of the story. Yeah. I think it's really great, and I just, yeah, and it... And
I don't know, like, if directors just always have to say this, but she made a point of being like, yeah, Benicio del Toro and David Duchovny and Halle Berry were all my first choices for this, and I was like, really? Europeans, what are you gonna do?
I mean, if anything, I just felt like none of the David Duchovny, Halle Berry romance or their families interacting. I love her brother, by the way. Her brother is so...
And her mom?
I don't remember her mom, but I remember her brother and loving him.
Her mom's really funny in it. She only has, like, one scene, but
it's
great.
Yeah, I just... that was never unbelievable for me. If anything, it was harder for me to understand how Benicio del Toro's character and David Duchovny were such good friends.
Aww.
No, I just... I didn't buy the... he's sticking around in this guy's life because he's just, like, a good Samaritan. Like, it just seemed a little sketchy to me. Like, I almost felt like... it seemed a little unbelievable. Like, I was like, is David Duchovny using also? I mean, I just don't really get why you'd be this close with someone who's so troubled if you weren't...
Really, because I absolutely believe the Duchovny-Del Toro relationship and did not believe a single thing that was happening the whole time. Halle Berry was like, come, heroin addict, live in my house.
Yes.
Well, something we remark on in several films is that money is never discussed. And I think it's a little weird that, like, this woman is, like, a housewife and then her husband dies. And she kind of mentions it once, but I almost think she's using it as an excuse to get Del Toro to move into her house. And she doesn't have any money problems. She lives in this, you know, very nice home. And I guess the neighbor makes this very oblique comment about David Duchovny was good at his job, therefore, like, Halle Berry will never have to worry about money. It just seemed very unrealistic to me that, like, this, like, young couple in their mid-30s would have planned so well for his, like, immediate death.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. We can look at Heath Ledger and see that how he didn't change his...
Oh!
He did not change his will, I just want to say. His daughter was not listed.
Oh, yeah, I heard that.
Anyway, no, I agree
And can
with
I
you.
Just also say one thing that also really did not work for me in this film? Yes. There was just something I found really disgusting about the choice to make the Del Toro character a heroin addict. Like, I feel like I just would have been able to go along with this so much more easily if he'd just been an alcoholic or, like, some kind of more relatable, less just horrifying kind of addict. Like, there's just something about, like, this middle-class Seattle suburbanite mom of two, like, young children bringing a heroin addict into her house that, like, it just, like, I felt like the brakes were constantly screeching on during the story for me.
You know, it's funny.
And it could have been adjusted very easily.
You know, the only thing that the heroin addict characterization provided for me was there's one scene that I find really unbelievable, but I also think it's interesting at the same time, is when Halle Berry decides she's got to go, like, claim Benicio del Toro's ass, like, from the heroin alley, basically.
Just like Angelina Jolie going to Africa.
Yeah, pretty much.
She's going to save all the babies.
Yeah, and so that scene.
And then she brings him back to detox, like to have this violent detox in her home, which one, seemed medically infeasible, and then two, really, like your children are like 10 feet away and you're going to have this heroin addict going through violent withdrawal, like,
yeah,
no. Just no.
Two things I want to add about that. And they're kind of about race and class, which go into what we were saying. There's something about her when she parks her car in this shady alley and goes looking for him. I almost felt like
her shiny, like, Lexus, like, SUV.
Yeah. There's something kind of interesting about this scene where it's like the young, she's youngish. I'm gonna call her youngish. The youngish, yeah, like, black woman coming to get this, like, loser. Is Benicio, I'm going to identify him as white, even though he isn't exactly white, but coming to, like, drag him away, and no one stops her and is like, hey, rich lady, what are you doing here? It's kind of like this interesting moment where she's able to, like, enter in and grab him, and it's just kind of an interesting moment for me. But then, at the same time, that moment kind of gets crushed when she treats her brother constantly like he's the hired help. Like, she's like, hey, younger brother, you're gonna just, you know, be the, like, janitor for this, like, loser white heroin addict guy. It was definitely bothersome for me.
I guess she let him take a break from pretending to be her dead husband on AIM.
Exactly. You know, I just want to quickly say that I actually liked the AA stuff in this film. I thought it was, for once, treated kind of carefully and respectfully compared to other, like, addiction recovery meeting type things I see in film, you know? Like, it's always such a joke. Like, no one ever takes it seriously. Like, Fight Club or whatever, like, whenever there's, like, people meeting in an addiction, like, group therapy situation on film, it's always treated so, like, you know, like it's a joke. And I actually thought it was treated well here.
Yeah, which we should mention, Alison Lohman has a small part in this film. I'm not sure why they cast such a big-name actress in this hardly anything role, but she's great as
that's
always.
That's funny, because wasn't she MIA since White Olander? For anyone who listened to our last podcast about Amy Heckerling, that's a joke for you. But, so yeah, I just want to also say, I think it's fine if we keep talking for a little bit since I haven't seen After the Wedding, but,
it's a podcast. Just let it roll.
I think that Halle Berry is actually pretty phenomenal in this role, Erin.
Oh yeah?
Yeah. Like I never really, like, I don't know. I haven't seen her in much where she was really able to be more than just like a hot James Bond girl. And, I think I finally understand why she was, you know, won an Academy Award. I think that she's actually pretty brilliant here, and I think that this is an excellent role, and I completely understand why she would take a role in a film that she probably knew wasn't going to have a lot of success, and a lot of people weren't going to see it.
And probably took a big pay cut.
I mean, she actually gets to be, I think, a complex, interesting character, and there isn't any... She doesn't have to have sex with any, like, gross white guys. Like, I feel like she always does in films. And,
I'm just gonna say, I hate Monsters Ball so much.
Yeah, I mean, and that's... I want to talk about that in a minute. Since we're gonna talk about its spotlight on things we lost in the fire. But, yeah, I have to say, this was actually the first Suzanne Bier film I've ever seen. And, you know, I think I understand why her films are being actually remade for the U.S., because I feel like she's got this really classical sense of filmmaking and language of cinema down, but I feel like she's also really safe in a lot of ways, which I think is very U.S., if you know what I mean.
Snap.
Yeah, I just feel like the film never really diverges off the path it's on, and it also, it really, in a lot of ways, even though I like it, to some extent, it's never much more than an upper middle class fantasy gone sour, only to reemerge the way that upper middle class fantasies can and are allowed to. You know,
Manola Dargis described After the Wedding, but I think it really applies well to Things We Lost in the Fire, as effectively unadventurous work.
Yeah.
I thought that was, like, perfect.
And the thing is, I don't necessarily think there's anything wrong with unadventurous work. I mean, it's done, it's done well. It's just not necessarily my cup of tea here, but I still would recommend this film, and I like it, actually. And I'm excited.
Yeah, I want to say, like, I know I've been kind of bagging on it, but I do think it's really kind of emotionally honest, even if, like, not everything happening in the film jives all the time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Suzanne Bier is definitely, you know, she's a prolific director for a reason. I mean, she's churning out films, like, that are critically acclaimed almost year by year, and you know, I think it's interesting that the women in all of her films seem to be making really questionable, I don't want to say poor, but really questionable decisions in relation to the men that they take into their lives, especially the men they take into their lives considering they've got children around as well. It's something we see in Brothers as well. You know, I just, in some ways I almost feel like Things We Lost in the Fire is almost this weird remake of Brothers.
But we'll get to that.
We'll get to that in a second, but it's just, and, you know, I like that these films never become over-sentimental, although I have to say, they do feel at times quite heavy-handed, but they're never overly sentimental. and quickly, and you can jump in at any moment, Erin.
No.
I liked the cinematography. I liked the close-ups, especially of eyes, and disagree with some critics who said that it just makes the film over-stylized, and I think you're one of those critics.
I like that.
Okay.
You never heard me say that.
well, I kind of found it reminiscent of, not that she's anywhere near as great, but as, you know, reminiscent of some of, like, Robert Bresson's shot compositions, just the look of them, and I wanted, if anything, more of those shots. It's kind of what kept the film from being totally straight, you know? the eye in which, like, we're seeing the film through, and I wanted more of that. And there's a quote from Suzanne Beer. I know you love it when I read quotes.
I was like, where is Kathy's quote?
I have a quota, and it's that I use handheld cameras in order to enable actors to move around freely because I want them to be truthful at all times, and that means they should be able to move and not be bound by a fixed camera position. I think if it's used for style, it's a mistake. It's there to do something very specific.
Yeah, are you listening, Dogma filmmakers? It's not there as a style.
Who? Dogma? Are you listening to anyone who's trying to shoot something on digital video right now? I think that's... I am any student.
I'm talking about anyone who's trying to make a crazy handheld film.
I just want to say that I think this film definitely could have had better marketing. Wouldn't you agree, Erin?
What marketing? Oh my gosh. Can I just say a few things about the story quick before we go into marketing? Just three quick points I wanted to point out. I love the next door neighbor in this film, this character. I didn't really understand. I feel like there are going to be scenes that were cut out that made more sense with his character, that might be on the DVD. But he was the Zodiac killer in Zodiac, a film I loved last year. Yeah, and so seeing him here is this, like, dopey suburban neighbor who's just, like, trying to help out and just wants a buddy to go jogging with. Like, I just loved
Erin,
it.
I think you just ruined Zodiac, which I haven't seen for me.
I'm absolutely not, no.
Okay.
The Zodiac killer actually is still out there, Kathy.
Stop it. Okay, what are the other 2 points you want to mention?
Okay, 10-year-old with a cell phone, WTF. I don't have kids, so I can't say, but seriously, do 10-year-olds just walk around with cell phones
Erin,
now?
The youngest kids have cell phones now. It's disgusting.
Okay. And my last one was that I hated the music in this movie. There's like, a Spanish guitar playing 4 notes that just comes on anytime you're supposed to feel anything. It's like Halle Berry, like, don't Benicio del Toro, don't leave the house. Do-do-do-do-do.
Erin, I just want to say, I don't,
over and
I don't
over.
Remember the
Those
music
same four notes.
At all.
What?
I don't.
You what?
I just don't remember the music.
It was terrible.
I bet it was, because I don't remember it. But,
Do-do-do-do-do!
Yeah, I just wish...
Over and over.
Yeah, I feel like this film was marketed to look like it was, like, a Halle Berry, Benicio del Toro love story, and I'm so glad that it wasn't, but I'm also...
Those people are bummed out that went to go see that
movie. Yeah, those people are bummed out, and it bums me out that people realize that this is a good way to market it, because people, what do they want from a movie? They want to see the wrong people having sex with each other? I don't understand. I'm so glad I didn't have to witness them having sex, mostly because I just think Benicio del Toro is gross, and...
That would be a terrible term for the plot, but we need to stick a fork in this review.
We need to stick a fork in this review. Anyway, I recommend Things We Lost in Fire, and we actually haven't given away too much, because the movie has no surprises.
It's about the experience you have with these characters. It's not really about a plot happening.
And Halle Berry, amazing. You should watch it. If you've ever wondered what people see in Halle Berry, or if you already love Halle Berry, you should just see this film. She's pretty amazing in it.
Actually, one more thing. Did the two children in this movie, do you think they were wearing matching wigs?
I didn't think they had wigs on.
One was a boy and one was a girl, and I swear to God, I couldn't tell them apart because they were wearing the same hair. And I was like, did a stylist put, like, the same wig on these two kids? Like, what happened?
I think I'm not going to comment on that, but that's a good point, I guess. Anyway.
On with the show.
On with the show. So, on with the show, we're going to backtrack an entire year to a film Suzanne Beer made in 2006. Erin, can you tell us about our next film?
All right, dear listeners. I wasn't quite prepared to do this, so I'm just going to read a quick plot summary. To save the failing orphanage he runs in India, Danish transplant Jacob Peterson returns to his homeland to meet a self-indulgent businessman named Jorgen, who offered a generous donation, and who represents everything the noble-minded Jacob abhors. Complicating matters further are the unusual strings Jorgen has attached to his so-called gift. Rolf Lustgaard co-stars in this Oscar-nominated emotional powerhouse of a drama. That is such a cheesily written plot summary of what this film is about, and I apologize.
Well, I just want to tell our listeners, I actually wasn't able to see this film, because we don't need to talk about it, but I just wasn't. And so I'm going to really be asking Aaron some questions about it.
Awesome. I'm sad, though, because this is actually my favorite film that we're reviewing today.
Well, what's funny is that this is the film by Suzanne Beer that I've wanted to see more than any of her other films. But just to play it on the safe side, I knew that you had already seen this film, so I knew that it was the film that I needed to watch last in order for us to really be able to talk about all these, just in case you weren't able to watch one of the others.
Oh.
Then I became crazy busy, and the rest is history.
All right, moving on.
As Aaron would say, Merry Dismas after the wedding.
I do say that.
Okay, Aaron, so tell me, why is this your favorite film that we're reviewing today?
You know, this totally falls into the same category as The Namesake. It was one of those films at the end of 2007 that I raced to watch just out of, like, obligation to feel like I needed to see all the quote-unquote important movies of 2007. And I think that was actually before the nominations came out for Oscars that year. And I was stunned. I loved it. I think I was watching it while wrapping presents and totally didn't wrap any presents. I was just blown away. I think very, very similar to what I felt were the good things in The Things We Lost in the Fire. This is like a very crazy melodrama where there's just tons of like twists and turns and complicated emotions and things being dredged up from the past and new aggressions and people are dying, people are fighting, and people are making up. But, like, it's all just so believable. And all of these characters are very well rendered. And I really enjoyed spending time with them. And I could really believe that they would all exist after the film ended. And also, the main dude in it looks just like Viggo Mortensen.
That's funny. I thought that he looked like Robert Burke from Hal Hartley's Simple Men.
I don't know who that is.
He was, like, RoboCop 3, I think.
What?
Yes.
Another great thing about this movie, it taught me that in Holland, Christina is not a girl's name. True story.
Wow. You know, Aaron, I wanted to see this film and thought that it looked like, you know, the Dogma 95 film, The Celebration, which I really actually love and saw on my 18th birthday.
Because there might be less dysfunction in After the Wedding than Celebration, but not by a lot.
Yeah, it looks pretty dysfunctional based on the trailer. And I want to let our listeners know, and you know, that I fully intend to watch this tonight, even though I haven't slept in about 8 years.
What? Yes.
Anyway, it looks like a Dogma 95 film to me, and then it turns out that it was actually co-written by Suzanne Beer and Anders Thomas Jensen, who is 1,000% a Dogma filmmaker. So it makes sense.
Which ones did he do?
He actually did, he wrote Mifune, which I actually disliked and found weird and problematic in relation to how the female gender was treated. Surprise, Dogma could be sexist. He also wrote The King is Alive, which I've always wanted to see.
Oh, me too. I've actually rented that and then just not been able to watch it.
Me too. I've always wanted to see that film.
What?
And he wrote Wilbur Wants to Kill Himself, which I've heard amazing things about.
That's a good one.
And he co-wrote Brothers, which we'll be talking about in a few minutes. And Aaron, what? I think most excitingly for you and I is that he is part of the Red Road filmmaking series. And we reviewed Andrea Arnold's film Red Road a few months ago when we first started this podcast. It's a film we both really like. And he, you know, helped create characters for that film, and I think we'll be directing his own version based on those characters that were in.
Is he the one that dropped out when Andrea Arnold started getting all those great reviews?
Probably. Who knows?
One of them just dropped out. He's like, no, I can't do it. We let the girl go first, and now I just can't.
You know, I'm actually, you know, really excited about this writer and really want to see this film even more now. And so, Aaron, I have a question for you. What I actually like about Suzanne Beer's films, now that I've seen a couple, is that, like I said, there really aren't any surprises. Because it's, like, everything as outrageous as it seems to be, like, a heroin addict comes and lives with me, or, you know, my husband is a prisoner of war. Like, everything that happens within those situations seems so normal for that world, you know, that's been created.
Yeah.
But I wonder, this film, After the Wedding, seems like secrets might be a big part of the plot. Is that true, and did it work for you, and was it different from her other films in that respect?
I think if this wasn't the first Suzanne Beer film I'd seen, I wouldn't have been as surprised. As it were, I was just, you know, when you hear, like, like, Dutch family drama that's going to be nominated for an Academy Award, you just don't think it's going to get as, like, psycho melodrama as this film does. So I was a little bit surprised by that. But I think now that you know a little bit about Suzanne Beer's style and what she enjoys in storytelling, you'll be a little bit more prepared for it. I want to convey, I really do love this film, and I think what makes the it's well-grounded melodrama, if there is such a thing, and it's because these characters are, it's very well cast, they're very well written, the tone is perfectly handled. Even though crazy things are happening, you just feel like there's a strong hand at work here, and you're going to be well guided down this path.
All right, so does that mean secrets are a big part of the plot?
I mean, secrets are a big part of the plot, but I think you'll be able to go along with it.
Aaron, what were the politics like in this film? I know that the film involves, like, a white Danish man managing an orphanage in India. I'm just curious, how was that handled? Because I could imagine 1,000 billion filmmakers mishandling, the scenes in India. And so I just wonder what you thought of it.
The scenes in India are pretty brief. You're not really given a lot of time to think about that. And I didn't even realize watching it that he was in charge. I got the sense he was a volunteer. And I didn't even know until, like, quite late in the film that he had adopted one of the children there. And I didn't quite understand why, if he was the legal guardian of this child, why he couldn't just send for him.
I think Suzanne
Beer, to come live in Holland.
Now that I know this and your relationship to the instant messaging in Things We Lost in the Fire, I think Suzanne Beer messes with your head, Aaron.
Messes with just my head?
Yes, I'm just teasing.
He's also very tan, so maybe I didn't even understand at the time that he was a white Dutch man.
Well, maybe he's not, I just assumed. Aaron, what are the women in this film treated like? Because I just know that in all of these films, it's been all these films that we've seen by Suzanne Beer, and most of the films I've seen by the person she's co-written with, they've weirded me out in the sense that there's, like, this different kind of treatment toward women that I feel like is not really accepted so much in films in the U.S. I don't know if you agree with me or not, but I just feel like women get treated and mistreated in these ways or make these decisions that seem really kind of scary for them, and I just wonder, what were the women treated like in this film?
The women are a lot more passive characters in After the Wedding than they are in Brothers or Things We Lost in the Fire. It's kind of like this melodrama happening mostly between these men. I mean, the women are part of it, and they're proxy for a lot of the emotions, but I feel like the relationship is really between this wealthy businessman and the man who's taken the more idealistic road.
Yeah, you know, a friend today just told me that she saw After the Wedding, and I told her, oh, we're reviewing it on this podcast about the director Suzanne Beer, and she said, what? That was directed by a woman? I really thought that was directed by a man.
It is a manodrama.
It's a manodrama. Aaron, is there... And I haven't seen the film, so I can't really elaborate on what she meant. And then she tried to explain it to me, and I think I understand. She just, I guess, something that happens in Suzanne Beer's films that we've seen, they seem very gender neutral in the storytelling, kind of, if that, like, they're often about men and women very equally, you know? Like, I feel like each thing we've seen has been, personally for me, just as much about the men as it has the women, but maybe it's a little different in this film.
Well, I think it's also that all of her films take place in crisis.
Yes.
So there is something sort of neutralizing about gender roles in those situations.
No, that's...
And that definitely is the case in After the Wedding as well.
That's a good, that is a good bit of, a good little insight there you have there. But, Aaron, is there, violence in this film? Because that's definitely something I've seen in her film.
Nothing compared to what we're going to be talking about in Brothers.
But
I think there's one scene where someone gets upset and hits someone else, but it's just kind of a drunk bar fight.
Okay, I've heard that the director of photography on this film uses a lot of extreme close-ups. What did you think about the camera work here?
You know, I remember thinking the camera work seemed very loose and handheld, but I can't really offer any particular insight to how it was shot.
But, I mean, did you like it? Was it ever bothersome to you, or...?
It always worked for me. It was intimate. So, and I think I knew going in that this was a at least tangentially related Dogma production.
And so you always expect a little motion sickness with that?
I was, like, buckled into the sofa.
I couldn't get you to see Cloverfield, but you're seeing all these Dogma films.
It's not as bad on DVD because you can kind of walk around and look away. I don't know. There's more.
Wow. Okay, so I have a little piece of trivia that kind of relates to the editing of this film.
Oh, boy.
I just read on IMDb.com that at a showing at a film festival in Estonia, two of the reels to this film had been switched by a mistake, making a part of the film out of place. And apparently the majority of the audience didn't notice and was generally very enthusiastic about the movie, despite the narrative being mixed up.
That's funny, because out of all the films, like, this is the one with no jumping around, no flashbacks. I'm really surprised to hear that. This is a very linear story.
All right.
What?
I've heard the other things from
Estonia. Stop it.
Yeah, I really want to see this film. I know that you strongly recommend it, and I'm going to watch it very soon.
Excellent.
Oh, and this is what I want to say. I want to say that... the last thing I want to say about this film that I haven't seen is that I especially wanted to see it because I think the film that she made, like, 2 years before this, Brothers, that we're about to talk about, isn't quite as polished as I would like it to be. And I feel like the film that she made a year after this film, The Things We Lost in the Fire, that we just talked about, is almost too polished. And so I really felt very strongly that this would be the Suzanne Beer film for me.
This will be the Goldilocks. The porridge is just right.
This would be the right porridge.
Excellent.
All right, so should we move on to the last cup of porridge, Erin?
Sure. After the Wedding is available on DVD, and I strongly recommend it, and I bet by later tonight, Kathy will be strongly recommending it as well.
Except I'll be asleep and not able to tell anyone.
It's true. Kathy, why don't you tell us a little bit about Brothers?
Okay. Brothers is Suzanne Beer's 2004 film, which is about two interwoven storylines, one about the relationship between two brothers who don't quite get along, and the other about the difference between comfortable Western civilization sending out soldiers to various missions and what the actual war zones are like. These stories mirror each other and both brothers change roles during the film. One starts in prison, the other ends up there. One is a family man, the other takes over this role after his brother's death, and we'll put death in quotes, very big quotes. Brothers is a complicated film about, well, brotherhood.
Kathy and I had a little miscommunication this morning, so we both wrote introductions to Brothers. I like yours. We can go with that.
No, you should read yours, and then in the editing, I'll figure out which one to put. I'll just splice okay. them together, so it'll be me saying a sentence and you saying a sentence.
Just like in Estonia. All right. In Brothers, Suzanne Beard's eighth film, we meet two brothers, Michael, an accomplished military officer and family man, and Janik has been recently released, who has been recently released from prison for beating up a woman in part of a robbery. When Michael's helicopter is shot down during his deployment to Afghanistan and he is believed to be dead, the family's dynamic is forever changed, and it falls upon his wife, Sarah, played by Connie Nielsen, to stitch it back together. Sound familiar? The first half of this film is thematically very similar to Beer's most recent film, The Things We Lost in the Fire. Kathy, did this make you feel robbed?
No, Erin, it doesn't make me feel robbed, because I guess I believe that, you know, it's something that I think many people, many film critics and many filmmakers believe, and that's that a filmmaker is constantly remaking the same film because there's always this... there's always this one thing that you're trying to say as an artist, and you never get it right, or chances are you never get it quite right. So you're constantly having to figure out new ways to try and get it right, and so... I don't feel robbed. I just think that it's really interesting, actually, that I feel like she is telling the same story.
Do you think that's where the idea for Groundhog's Day came up? It's how every filmmaker is living their life?
I'm going to say no. Erin, well, first I just want to say that Brothers actually was a widely critically acclaimed film that is actually now going to be remade into a version for the U.S., which I kind of think is a little bit disgusting, but that's just my opinion, and it will be directed by Jim Sheridan. And
really?
Yes, and the version does credit Suzanne Beer as the writer or co-writer, but the film is going to star, brace yourself, Erin, Natalie Portman.
Oh, I hate it already.
Jake Gyllenhaal.
No!
Wait for it. And Tobey Maguire.
What?
That's right.
Okay, show me your titles. We're going to do an episode called Unnecessary Remakes. Brothers 2008 is going to be the first one on it.
Yeah, I just...
Also, you know who's remaking her sex movie,
Open Hearts,
I don't
want to talk about it.
Are you serious?
It's so upsetting.
All right, well, cover your ears, because I'm going to tell our listeners real quick. Suzanne Beers also made a very sex-oriented movie that I really wish we could have reviewed today, but we're a family podcast. And that film is being remade by, Kathy, are you covering your ears?
Yes.
Number one enemy to Show Me Your Titles, Zach Braff. We're in awe.
Yeah, so not only is Zach Braff, has he bought the rights and is going to remake it, but he's also the only person, as of right now, slated to star in the film. I hope...
Oh, God.
I can only hope it's a one-man show, Zach Braff playing everyone in open heart.
And the guy in it, he's like a paraplegic, so it's going to be Zach Braff in a wheelchair having crazy monkey sex.
Yeah, sounds fantastic.
With probably Natalie Portman again, right?
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, back to Brothers before I get really upset. You know, I liked Brothers, Aaron, except I felt that it was extremely heavy-handed. It was hard for me to enjoy. It was so heavy-handed and kind of over the top at times.
I kind of hate this movie. I loved it at first. I loved it when, because for the first 45 minutes, we kind of don't believe, we kind of believe that this, Michael, the family man, died in Afghanistan. We go for a very long time before we realize he's actually in a POW camp. And I think the movie, it does some interesting things in the POW camp. I liked that stuff because I think it's pretty, maybe not realistic, but it's definitely representing the end of the spectrum of possibilities for what happens to people in POW camps. But basically, when he is rescued from the POW camp, I think this movie completely goes off the rails. And frankly, like, seeing... I did not know this was going to be made into an American film. In an American context, like, this... What happens in this movie, what transpires, is such an over-the-top, offensive, horrible set of circumstances. Like, I think it's going to be really offensive in an American version.
I completely agree, actually. I was going to ask you how you felt about that, because, I mean, it's just in a...
Oh, we should say.
Today at this point, we have films like Redacted and the upcoming Kimberly Pierce film, and I just feel like this is just... And what was the other film? Rendition? Was that the film with Jake Gyllenhaal and...
Yeah, but that's not really about...
Yeah, I know. I just feel like there's...
In the Valley of Elah has a very similar subplot as this film that I found so incredibly offensive.
Yeah, it's a weird thing, this new genre of film.
Well, we should say, you know, some very horrible things happen to this man in the POW camp, and maybe Kathy will want to talk about that. And then, basically, he comes back, he's undiagnosed with PTSD. He comes back, is immediately acting very inappropriately and very violently towards his family, and eventually, like, very nearly kills everyone, and the cops come, and he tries to, like, shoot the cops, and it's this horrible, over-the-top stereotype of what the worst symptoms of PTSD can be.
It's really offensive also in that, it's really, there's no way you can watch it and not think that the filmmakers were trying to use something that actually does happen to people and is really intense and really serious and use it as this way of saying the war is bad, fighting is bad. And it's just really upsetting here and gross. And the fact that, you know, his perfect, blonde, beautiful wife and children just expect him to be completely normal and don't ask him what happened to him when he got back. It's just so unbelievable. They just kind of watch him and smile and don't understand why he wants to, like, curl up in the fetal position as soon as he gets home.
Yeah.
It's pretty upsetting. I just don't think that it's cool to use, you know, thing. I don't know. I just don't think it's very, I just don't think it's the most intelligent way of expressing what is wrong with...
It's really not. And can I just say, in the Valley of Elah, I'm going to go ahead and spoil this film. Michael, he's thwarted. He's not able to murder his wife and children or his brother or any of the police officers in the struggle that happens in this film. But in the Valley of Elah, we do see the woman is killed, and it's in this very horrible way. And you see very graphic images of it. And, like, it's basically only exist in the story to move this very small cog in the plot forward. I mean, I almost found myself watching Brothers sort of relieved that we don't see any of those images, and then I just realized, like, how far low is this bar set that, like, I can be relieved that these, like, images, like, just because I'm not graphically seeing it doesn't mean that, like, this incredible, incredibly hurtful stereotype is any less damaging. I mean, I was inspired to look up some numbers. I don't know if you want to hear
these, Kathy. Yeah, of course.
According to the New York Times, and this is, okay, this film we're reviewing today is set in Holland, but I could only find American statistics, and really, I think this movie is about America anyway, so.
I do, too. I completely do. It reminded me of Lars von Trier's Dogville.
I haven't seen that.
Isn't that what it's called with Nicole Kidman?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry, go on.
I just haven't seen it. Of the 380,000 American troops that have been deployed to Iraq that have come back or cycled through, there have been 120 of them who went to Iraq with no criminal record have come back and committed some kind of violent crime. Now, obviously, that is 121 too many, but to put that in perspective, that is 0.00031% of people come back with PTSD and commit a violent act, and yet that is, like, the number one portrayal of PTSD that you see in films. And when people talk about how, you know, they're scared or they, you know, they don't want to be viewed as weak when they go to seek treatment, like, this is why there is a stigma. Like, films like this kind of casual attitude that I think exists in the civilian population, in pockets of the civilian population, I should say, that just, oh, like, if you go to war, you're going to come back with PTSD, and if you have PTSD, you're going to be, like, a raging, bloodthirsty killer, and there's going to be nothing that anyone can do. And it's just so wrong-headed. It's just completely wrong. On every level, it fails at the logic.
No, I completely agree. If my hand wasn't holding the phone, I would applaud you, Erin. I'll try and find an applause track to put after that statement.
And I mean, it pains me to say this because I feel like I like Suzanne Bier. I probably have, like, very similar values that she has. And I love that Connie Nielsen, who I thought was an American, but is actually natively Swedish but speaks Dutch, was in this film speaking a foreign tongue. I was really impressed with her. I think she carried it off all very well. I just think this story is a mess.
No, I completely agree with you. I don't want to talk about it too much, but I do have to say this film does contain one of the most upsetting scenes of violence I have ever seen in a film. Luckily, there isn't actually too much, like, graphicness in terms of, like, blood and gore, but yeah. What's happening, the sounds you're hearing, and what you know is happening is one of the most...
You're really experiencing it, yeah.
You're really experiencing it, and it's one of the most cruel and upsetting things I've ever seen, ever, okay?
I think it might replace the final image of Doom Generation as that image in my mind that I sometimes see when I can't sleep at night, that I can't, like, get out of my head.
Yeah, I think it might replace that Russian film I saw when I was, like, 15 called, like, Freeze, Die, Come to Life, when a woman drowns kittens... And
oh my god.
Hey, Russia, it's not been the easiest place to live there, and they can drown some kittens if they want to.
Just for fun? What are we talking about?
Anyway, yes, I am gonna equate it with drowning kittens, except much, much worse.
Yeah, I think it might be worse than watching someone drown kittens.
But I also think it's...
Oh!
Yes.
Oh.
I have to say, I also think that it's the best scene in the film. It's really... I almost feel like the film was created just so that they could have that scene. Because it's so much stronger than where the idea of it and... what leads right up to it, the conversation the two men have,
Wait, I'm sorry, so am I supposed to believe Tobey Maguire is going to be this guy living in the POW camp?
And I'm supposed to believe that Jake Gyllenhaal is going to beat him to death with a pole?
Or, I assume Jake Gyllenhaal is going to be, like, the naughty brother.
Oh.
Because he has brunette hair.
Oh yeah, you're totally right.
And I'm raised on Disney.
Yeah, I have no idea. Anyway, we are confusing the listeners who have probably stopped listening, but I think it's one of the best in the film, and it's funny because it's so violent and upsetting, and I say it's the best in the film, but that doesn't necessarily that doesn't necessarily mean that I approve of it and think it's great. I think it's really upsetting and Anyway, but what I do want to say about it is it reminds me of something a good friend of mine once said when we were watching, you know, the classic film Showgirls and Paul Verhoeven's masterpiece. and, you know, in it, there's one of the most graphic, upsetting, horrible gang rape scenes that's so unnecessary, as I believe all rape scenes are in film. But my friend said to me the most intelligent thing ever that anyone could ever say about Showgirls, and that was that she felt like the filmmaker really was like, how can I show this? Because this is all I want to show. I don't want to show anything else. I just want to show this violent, horrible, ugly gang rape scene. So what movie can I build around it to show it? And I think when it comes down to it, that really is what is going on in many ways with film and with this film and that scene. So as much as I, you know, think that that scene is extremely well done and, like I said, what leads up to it and is extremely, extremely well written and directed, more than anything else in the film, I also wonder, you know, what really value does this film have when I feel like it was all created just so that they could get to that, you know?
Yeah.
Although, I don't know, I have conflicted feelings about this film for sure. I just want to say that I hated the ending. It's the most tacked on ending ever. I could just make fun of that ending for years. It's so ridiculous.
Yeah, all I want to say about that ending is, why are Danish prisons nicer than my apartment?
Yeah, why are Danish prisons like where Martha Stewart went to prison? And anyway,
Well, I want to get back to the thing I bookmarked in our Things We Lost in the Fire review. Because there is a scene in this film where the guy comes back and pretends to a war widow that her husband is still alive when this man knows for damn sure that this man is dead, basically because he's a coward. And I think it's very odd that in these two movies there are two scenes where people basically, just out of self-protection, when there are plenty of other options available to them, lie to someone and pretend that someone very close to them is still alive who they know is dead. And I think it's a lot more offensive in Brothers, even though the technology aspect is not present here, which very much irks me.
I felt like it was a lot less out of cowardliness in Things We Lost in the Fire. I felt like it was more about the urgency of what to do in this crisis situation. Like, you don't know, like, what to do with your outgoing answering message that has, like, your dead lover's voice on it until it actually happens. Like, you know, like, those things. Like, you don't know how to respond.
I don't hold it as much against the character, Halle Berry's character, in Things We Lost in the Fire, and it's not as damaging in that one. In Brothers, it's really out of the park.
No, in Brothers, it's out of the park. I mean, it's gross because it really, I feel like, villainizes a character that, had he not done that, gone to see the wife and lie to her, I feel like it makes him seem like a sociopath in a way. And before it was like, he's a man who, this is the only way he can save his life and get back to his family, and it's either that or they both die. Like, that's a really different scenario, I believe, than, now I'm going to go and get close to his wife and meet her and see their baby. Like, it's just so...
Well, and also, we're supposed to believe that he's been discharged or he's not working anymore, and yet he goes in his uniform, thereby probably conveying to this woman that he's there in some sort of official capacity, delivering what is a complete fabrication of information to her.
Oh, he completely does, because when she opens the door to him, she says, oh, you guys come here all the time. It lets me know that, you know, he's still alive or something. So, I mean, yeah, it's so morally, it's like before he was in this situation that, yes, was morally corrupt and ambiguous, but it was a life or death matter, and now he's just completely morally bankrupt in that moment, you know?
Yeah.
So I know we need to wrap things up soon, but back to that ending that I hated, Aaron. I just felt...
At the IKEA prison?
In the IKEA prison. It just felt so tacked on, and what I feel like... It was an ending that I feel like the much more glossy Things We Lost in the Fire was more suited for, you know what I mean? Like, I felt like that ending just showed me that this was kind of a dogma film trying to get out of its hand-me-down clothes and squeeze into, like, a Prada suit, you know? Like, it's really, like, I feel like it's no longer, like... I can't buy it as kind of a, you know, DIY, like, indie film or something at that point. It's really trying to be, like, this mainstream conventional story at this point. That's just, it's, I don't know. I that's again why I completely understand why her films are being remade for U.S. audiences. They're quite accessible.
I can't believe this movie's being remade in America. People are gonna riot. Do they not understand how terrible this is?
Hey, before we go, I think I want to ask you what you thought of what I felt was kind of a scary sexuality thing all over this film, and I feel like I've seen in other recent Danish films. And it's really, there's kind of this really kind of abusive, like, violating power thing going on between men and women and in these films. And I don't know if you noticed, I mean, you had to notice it in this film. She really just kind of puts herself in these situations, much like Halle Berry, but different. She spends all this alone time with a man who, the wife in this film, with a man who has a really bad track record. He almost killed a woman and, like, went to jail for it. She spends all this time with him and takes showers while he's there, and it just puts herself and her children really close.
Has her children hanging out with him all the time,
and really crosses some boundaries with him. And then, you know, it's like we see her do this, and I don't know really what we're supposed to think about her based on this. And then when her husband comes back, he almost kills her several times. There are moments when, you know, the right thing to do would be to get the kids, get out of the house, don't come back. And as it's easier said than done, but she puts herself so close to the edge in this film, and I just don't feel like she were ever led to believe she's very intelligent. Like, you know, it's like she instantly, you know, her husband is supposed to be dead, and she just acts like everything's normal and says, well, I don't really feel like he's dead, and then ends up being completely fine, hanging out with, you know, his brother.
Yeah, oh my god, I never need to see another movie where, like, we think someone's dead, but the wife feels that he's not dead, and then he's not dead. Like, no.
Yeah, and
This isn't Disney, okay? No. Like, you're not allowed to feel that someone is actually alive.
You know, the wife has no emotions in this film. She is just completely this smiley, happy woman who even, it's not, and not in a bad way, just in a, like, naive way. She never seems like she's doesn't care about her husband, but she just seems really naive and young, and I don't really understand why she seems so...
Well, going back to your point about why she feels so comfortable with this, you know, quote-unquote bad brother who just got out of prison for almost killing a woman, I think we're supposed to put a lot more weight than I really believed on this scene where he comes back and tells her about this thing that he just did, where he goes to the woman that he almost killed. I believe it's in, like, part of a robbery that he, you know, beats her very viciously, and that's why he's just been out of prison. He goes to her and says, like, don't worry, I'm not dangerous, I'm not gonna come find you and hurt you, and he says that her reaction is like, oh, she's so relieved, she cried, she seemed really happy. And I was like, bullshit, like, whatever. I mean, it happens kind of early in the film, so I just didn't think about it one way or the other, but I was like, oh, is that why I'm totally cool with Connie Nielsen and her small children just living with this, like, sex predator?
Yeah, I was so upset. Like, I was so upset. I mean, that's something I didn't understand. Was he a rapist as well? Or did he just...
They keep saying assault. So I felt like, is that, like, Euro euphemism for he's also a rapist?
It was really hard for me to know what was going on there. But it just did not seem cool. And I couldn't really get into the fact that she was spending all this close time with him. And in both Things We Lost in the Fire and this film, Brothers... there are these, like, platonic relationships between heterosexual men and women where they get really close, really intimate, but don't have sex, and, you know,
they kiss, but then decide that's all they want to do.
Or, you know, yeah, or they lay in bed together, and it's just, I think, you know, Suzanne Bier is interested in, you know, these lines that men and women, heterosexual men and women can ride with each other, but... overall, I don't think she's really particularly interested in gender, or in the female gender, at least. I'm just not feeling that through these films. And, yeah, so that's really what I have to say. Hey, Erin, what did you think of the portrayal of Afghanistan here?
All I can think about is how much worse it's going to be in the American version.
But, I mean, I know, but what did you think about it here?
I thought it was whatever. I didn't really have any thoughts about it. What did you think about it?
I mean, it's just very, like, You know, it's very much very similar to the standard images. I feel like the U.S., you know, portrays in films that get made.
I have a book recommendation.
Yes.
Real Bad Arabs. R-E-E-L. Real bad.
Exactly.
I mean, it's basically like a scene from Delta Force.
Yeah, exactly. There's no,
There's no normal people. Like, it's only, like, these terrorist camps and then dirt. Like, you don't see any, like, just people living in Afghanistan.
Yeah, and of course, like, soldiers from the quote-unquote right side getting executed. Yeah, I was waiting for, like, you know, Steven Seagal or Jean-Claude Van Damme to, like, swing in. Or John Rambo.
Chuck Norris.
In fact.
Yeah.
But anyway, the last thing I want to say about this film is I actually... don't, like I've already said, I don't think the writing is very strong here. I think the strongest part of the film is definitely the acting, if anything. And I don't think it was the wisest. I don't actually think the parallel storytelling worked that well here. I think it was just an added-on thing to make this film seem more like an art film or something. And honestly, I felt like we were being a little beaten over the head with how tragic everything was, and I just felt it was like it was unnecessary. I mean, he's a prisoner of war. Like, we know it's tragic and upsetting, and I feel like this film wants to keep reminding us, you know, like we don't have a brain or eyes to see that what's happening. So overall, not the biggest fan of Brothers.
Me either.
So. Not that we want to say Merry Christmas, Suzanne Bier, but we just,
we want to say See After the Wedding instead of Brothers.
And I actually want to say you should see Things We Lost in the Fire as well.
Yeah, I think after all we've said about it, if you still want to see it, you'll enjoy it.
If you still want to see it, I'm going to recommend it and say that you should read The Lovely Bones with it. And Aaron is going to suggest that you should... Read
Real Bad Arabs, and then watch Brothers, and then watch the American version of Brothers, and then feel sad about the state of humanity.
Exactly. And on that note, thanks for listening. Oh, and before I forget, I am participating in a film screening this week. 2 hours worth of graduate student films. You know, you can't wait. Go to UCSD Open Studios. .com for more information. It's this Friday, April 4th from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. on the University of California, San Diego campus in the lovely visual arts facilities. Thank you.
Have a great week, everybody. You can email us any feedback at showmeyourtitles@gmail.com.
You can go to our website, leave us comments, download or listen to the podcast directly, www.showmeyourtitles.com. You can...
And check us out on MySpace and Facebook. We're everywhere.
It's true. Links to our MySpace and Facebook pages are on showmeyourtitles.com. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Talk to you next week when I am post-spring break. Goodbye.